Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Luke O'Neill. Thank you for downloading, subscribing and rating. Coming up on this week's show, why colour could be the key to reviving marine life and why is our Earth spinning faster? Now, if you'd like to get in touch with us, the podcast, you can email us science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter @NewstalkScience. And as ever, we get to all of your comments at the end of the show. First up, as always, it's time to look back at some of the breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Susan Kelleher of DCU and biochemist and science communicator Owen Murphy. You're both very welcome. So Owen, our first story is about the immune system. Now you're taking your life into your own hands here because I'm an immunologist.
But oh, easy on me, Luke.
But it looks fascinating. I missed this one, by the way. So tell us all about this. Sick faces, right?
Yeah, so look, this is a really interesting story. I'm looking at slightly different aspects of the role our immune system may play in trying to protect us and keep us healthy. So, you know, we all appreciate the importance of a functioning immune system. You know, it's a line of defence against the germs and any foreign invaders which might try and get in. If it's not working, we get recurring infections. If it's working too much, maybe we get allergic reactions to things which we shouldn't, and possibly even autoimmune diseases. But have you ever thought that maybe it could be doing something more than just reacting to invaders?
Yeah, right.
I'm guessing you haven't.
I haven't.
You
not
haven't.
Really,
okay,
no,
all right. So, well, what this study is looking at doing here is they've gone a bit further and they've used virtual reality headsets. Okay. Now, for the purpose of this study, they created these figures which came towards the participants wearing the VR headsets, and they call them avatars. Okay. Now, in the preparation for it, each person with the VR headset on would see a face of a person of the same sex with a neutral face. They then split into three groups. The person would either have face coming towards it, which was neutral, infected looking, okay, so maybe sneezing, coughing, rash, yep, or have fear in their face.
Right.
Now, what they found is that the participants responded differently when the avatars looked sick.
Right. Who thinks of these experiments, Owen, is the next question.
Well, I mean, I think this is quite a novel way of maybe fusing old school research and some maybe new technologies.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm guessing from your previous response, this is something that you never thought of.
Never in a million years.
Never in a million years. Okay. So what they found, first of all, yes, there was a difference in the response which the people had when they saw the sick face coming towards. So what they did was they asked them to press a button as quickly as possible after their face had been touched. Okay. Now, what happened in response to that was that the further away the sick people were, they pressed it faster.
Ah, right.
Compared to the others.
Yeah. Right.
So that was the kind of the actual action. But not only that, they found that there was an increase in the blood levels of certain immune cells.
Right.
So the type of immune cells are innate
lymphoid
cells. So these act as a kind of a detector mechanism and kind of boost the system after that. Am I okay on that, Luke?
Absolutely.
Okay, I was sweating on that one, okay. So that was the kind of immune response. But they also hooked them up to the brains. And they saw that by scanning the brains using MRI and other scanning techniques, they found that the brain reacted differently to sick people. So what this seems to be raising is the question, is there more going on? I mean, I took a train here today and there was a group of people sitting around me and some of them were sick and they were passing out legal medication to each other, talking about, you know, maybe this will make you better. And I kind of got that feeling, oh, I can't move. I feel a little bit uncomfortable here. But to me, that's my brain saying, look, you know, you'll be maybe you should move away. But the question here is there a connection between the brain and the immune system?
Yeah. What got me was, it's this business of the brain, there's a part of the brain that monitors personal space, right?
Mm.
And that bit lit up, didn't it?
Yeah.
To say, look, I'm not happy with my personal space, and there's a sick person in front of me. It was remarkable, wasn't it? That specific part of the brain lit up.
They saw two kind of activations. One, when the avatar came into that space, even with a neutral face. But when the avatar had the infected face, then the part which detected threat and danger lit up even brighter.
Right. Yeah, it's remarkable stuff, isn't it? And what got me was the innate lymphoid cells. There's a real change in their immune system by looking at someone with a sick face.
Yeah.
So we evolved all of us to respond to a facial cue here as well to boost our immune system. Very nice, very interesting, especially for an immunologist. Thanks for that first one. Now, Susan, you've got one. How much time did our ancestors spend up trees? And it's all about savannah living chimps, have been telling us.
When it is. And this is interesting. I climbed a lot of trees, but I think when I was a kid, but I think we're going a lot further back than that, than my childhood. And ultimately, this comes back to the idea that we have in our heads that we as mammals came out of the trees and then we stood upright. And then because we needed to, we got on our feet and we walked. And that's a lot of evolution has this idea that that's how we evolved. But this is a new study from the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig. And it's challenging this idea. And what it did was it studied wild chimpanzees for 5 months in a place called the Isa Valley, which is in western Tanzania. And western Tanzania, this particular valley, is a landscape that is made up of woodland, rocky outcrops, scattered grasslands, and woodland on its own. And it's one of the closest parallels to where they think we, our ancestors evolved, to that land areas where we kind of came out of the trees and started to walk. And the idea being that there is this land rather than just having forest and woodland. There's land in between forest and woodland. So we needed to learn to walk between those areas. And what the researchers did is they studied over around, well, across around 300 different zones, they watched how 14 adult chimps moved through their environment. So they monitored when they went onto the trees, whether they stood up or didn't stand up. And over 5 months, kind of got this idea of understanding how much they stood up or didn't stand up in different areas. And what they found was that the chimps in this part of the world, in this area, they stood up on trees as much as the chimps that lived in actually the forested area. The idea being that they didn't go down and stand on their feet down below because they had the land. They actually still did as much bipodal activity up on the trees. And it makes a difference. Basically, about 85% of their standing activity was on trees. And they also saw that there was a difference depending on the structure of the tree. So the width of the branches and how high they were and even the types of trees. But it changes their argument that the authors make is that it changes this idea that we didn't stand on our feet up in the trees when we didn't have to. Yeah. That the idea was that chimps wouldn't stand there and wouldn't, you know, that the bipedal activity had to occur when we went down onto the land. Whereas if these chimps stood up as much and moved around as much on the trees as the cousins that live in the forest, then there's no reason to, I have an idea that we didn't evolve to stand in the first place on the trees. So it's a bit of an unusual study, a very long study, 5 months. Well, looking at chimps in the wild is no easy feat, I suspect.
I had a read of it. It's very massively detailed. It's a huge amount of effort has gone into this.
Photographs of tree branching and whatnot.
I read the paper. I thought to myself, could it be we evolved bipedalism to climb trees?
Yes, or to reach for fruit. You know, there's to get to a taller branch on a tree, you know, this idea of having to become upright so that we could walk away and out of a forest may not be actually the case.
And you've disclosed you were a tree climber.
Big time, yeah.
Do you still climb trees if you get a chance?
Depends on the time of the day, Luke.
It does indeed. Very good, very interesting. Now, Owen, we're going to talk about something a bit gory but fascinating. Maggots. So Neanderthals were eating maggots.
Well, yes, I suppose the idea of eating maggots to all of us here might seem a little bit not overly appetizing, but this is a really important study because it challenges maybe some of the beliefs which we had about how Neanderthals lived and how their diet. So I'm going to start, Luke, with what if I said to you to give me a couple of words to describe Neanderthals, what would you think?
Very thick-browed, Stone Age, knuckle-dragging.
Okay. Caveman?
Caveman.
And I mean, that is true. So some of them did live in caves, but over time they lived in other types of dwellings. And I suppose there's a kind of belief that maybe they're much more complex than what we give them. You know, we talk about them in different ways. So there's a lot more to be said about Neanderthals. Now, what has generally been thought about their diet is that they were extreme carnivores, like a hyena or a lion. Now, why do we think that to be the case? Well, it's to do with bones that have been found in Neanderthals and these really high levels of nitrogen isotope, nitrogen 15. Now, this is generally found in carnivores, you know, meat eaters. The problem is, however, that just like ourselves, you know, we're like Neanderthals, we're from the same lineage originally. we are primates and our digestive systems and mechanisms are based to eat more veg than meat. So it isn't really, a lot of people aren't happy with that.
Yeah.
So the story behind this is that anthropological archaeologist, okay, that's a double one to spit out there, he was given a talk on how he believes that possibly what was happening was that Neanderthals were eating decaying meat. And in fact, it was the maggots that were growing on that meat, that were putrefying it, breaking it down, that were bringing in this high level of nitrogen 15 that would explain the high levels in their bones. He collaborated with Beisler. She was the one in the audience and saw this, and she was about to start another study to look and see if she could predict the date of decomposition or the date a body had died at. And she thought, maybe we can overlap her research here. So they went together and watched it. She collected bodies, stripped the muscles from decomposing bodies which had been donated to science over 2 years. She took them back to the lab, grew flies on them, extracted the larvae, and what she found was that the larvae which had decayed and putrefied the muscles of these bodies, donated to science, had actually much higher levels of nitrogen 15 in it.
Right.
Much higher than what was in the flesh itself.
Gotcha, yeah. So the signature was, it was all about N15 in the end, wasn't it?
N15,
and really good science here on it. I mean, I read the paper as well, and this looks very strong, this, doesn't it, in a sense, to
lots
explain.
Lots and lots of things. And I mean, look, I mean, I suppose the findings were, it was very clear what they were trying to show.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was a really nice collaboration. I suppose a nice story that one scientist listening to another scientist speaking picked up on something, said, we can work together on this. And maybe two different fields, but bring it together and find something we may never have worked on individually.
As often happens in science, actually, when interdisciplinarity emerges between people. What got me was, there's a headline, maggots were the secret sauce on Neanderthals' food.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose one of the parts there I didn't mention was that John Spieth, the original, the anthropologist that did, he had studied ethnographic information from around the world of these indigenous communities who lived similar to Neanderthals. And he had found that they didn't see maggots as something that was a last resort.
Mm. Yeah.
They actually... It was a nice food. It was something they would savour and look forward to eating.
A source of nutrition, even, yeah. But for me, reading this, I mean, you know, it must smell terrible. You know, so did the Neanderthals not have as big a sense of smell, maybe?
Well,
because we would be repulsed by rotting meat, wouldn't we,
Homo sapiens? But I wonder, and this was mentioned, that when the Europeans often went to colonise other parts of the world, they found that the indigenous people were eating maggots and the smells didn't bother them. But it bothered the Europeans.
Right.
So maybe that's something that's built into our brains there.
Right, yeah. Fascinating stuff. Neanderthals eating maggots. Now, Susan, your last one for us is lung on a chip.
Yes.
What is a lung on a chip?
So lung on a chip is, I think...
It's not about food now.
Not about food.
No,
about the next phase of how we're going to do science in a way that it allows us to sort of reduce the amount of animal testing that we have. So lung on chip is an example of an organ on a chip, which is basically a piece of plastic that is about the size of your thumbnail that would, well, maybe about the size of your thumb, depending on how big your thumbnails are. But they are kind of pieces of plastic that within which special types of cells are grown. And those types of cells kind of mimic what happens in the body in different parts. So for a lung, you'll have development of lung organs or organ-like material on these chips. And what they allow people to do is to test the interaction of whatever you might want with the cells without having to do an animal test or an in vitro testing. The important thing about animal testing is, while we know it's essential for developing future, you know, drugs, etc., and treatments, is that about 90% of clinical trials that are done with mice and animals fail in human participants. So if we could have a human-esque sort of halfway house where you could test some of the human cells in these sorts of fake environments, then you're onto a winner in terms of reducing animal testing. This group from Kyoto in Tokyo, they have now made basically the first type of lung on a chip that has both the upper and the lower respiratory cells, and they did it from just one human participant. And what's important there is that when you want to compare the two different areas of the lung, if you've got those two different areas of the lung from two different types of participants, then you're not going to be able to look at a kind of a universal trend. So they've made this for the first time, and they tested it against SARS-CoV-2, and they tested it against influenza virus, and they showed an immune response, different immune responses in the upper and the lower respiratory tracts. And so now they want to try to understand how they can use these little cells to, or these little the organs on the chip to test against sort of therapeutic agents for different antiviral diseases.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not cheap.
Yeah.
And it's very specialized, but it is very beneficial. There's a lot of work in Ireland right. on this area as well. And I think there's great scope for long-term investment.
And do they grow them from iPSCs? Am
that's
I right,
right.
there?
That, yeah,
that's
yeah.
what struck me as the interesting thing. Can you grow any cell in the body now almost?
Well, you tell me.
Ex vivo. Well, I'm setting you up there because I know the answer. But,
so go ahead.
I'm not sure. Possibly, but certainly you start with these stem cells, don't you?
Yeah,
and
you
then
start
they happen
with
to grow and lungs you can, on a chip.
Ultimately, you can, right? I mean, the idea of the stem cell is that depending on how it differentiates, you're going to get different cells. And one thing that I'm really interested in that area is as a surface scientist that depending on the stiffness, say, of the material, you will get different types of cells. So, you know, materials that are stiff will develop into bone cells, and surfaces that are soft, the right. stem cells will develop into softer tissue. So there's a lot of control that's needed. I don't know if it's one cell can make any cell in the body and one stem cell, but I mean, there's certainly like the way forward in terms of developing these kinds of chips. We need to be,
right.
Working with those kinds of cells.
And as you were saying, it's, you can replace animals, can't you? We want to replace animals in our research all the time, yeah. of course. And
or
this seems to be a really good option.
Reduce. Absolutely.
Exactly.
There's going to be a place for everything at the table, but at least this will give us a bit of an idea of how likely it is maybe to translate into human clinical
right.
trials.
Very good. Thank you very much, Susan. That was Susan Keller of the ECU, and I was also joined by biochemist and science communicator Owen Murphy, giving us the latest stories in science this week. Now, this one's a great one. I love this. What if saving marine life was as simple as adding a splash of colour? Around the world, our coastlines are becoming very grey and uniform. Certainly, it's the same in Ireland, lined with seawalls, and they're built of concrete, and they're all a little bit dull. But now, a new study out of Sydney suggests that coloured concrete could be a surprising secret weapon in restoring underwater ecosystems. And I'm very happy to be joined now by Holly Cunningham, who's lead author on a study that was done at Macquarie University. Holly, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Now, coloured seawalls. Tell us all about it.
Yes, so absolutely what you've just said, because natural shorelines are full of colours, yellows and reds and greens, and they're home to a wealth of diverse marine life. But when you think of a harbour and those concrete grey seawalls, they support much different kind of levels of biodiversity. But we wanted to know if colour can make a difference. And we're adding natural colour to the grey concrete in Sydney Harbour. And we think colour is important. I'll just bring you back to that first thing because it'll make the study make a lot more sense. And so if you imagine all of the marine life, your algae, your seaweeds, your barnacles, your oysters, swimming around in the ocean, looking for somewhere to grow and settle down. And some coloured habitat may be really more attractive than others, signaling a good, safe home, places to grow and survive, while other colours might be less inviting. So it might be all about where marine life wants to settle. Some colours could be really interesting, and those are missing from today's grey concrete. And colour might also influence who survives. So a bright green algae may blend into a green surface better than a red one. And when you have those grazing predatory fish coming along, they might feed on the most obvious kind of looking prey species or algae. Or predators might associate certain colours with good foraging grounds, so kind of beeline for them. So we think colour could affect marine life in a whole load of ways. And that's how we did our study. We created 160 square concrete panels. So we have grey, which is standard concrete, no colours added. Red and yellow, which we took from a natural habitat, Sydney sandstone, and a green colour, like the kind of algal biofilms you see on slippy rocks. And we bolted them to seawalls in Sydney Harbour.
Oh, that's heroic.
Somewhere low down.
But you did 160 panels, right? So there must have been a lot of labour involved in this to attach all these panels.
Yeah.
There must have been a huge amount of effort, was it?
Well, that's as thanks particularly to Laura Ryan and the team back at Macquarie. Yes, there was a whole team of us out there out there doing it, and then I sort of came in as we were placing the panels up.
Right, and then what did you find? So you some kind of very interesting observations in terms of specific colours, didn't you?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So we had all these panels up for a whole year, and it's a really really exciting observation. Was that our red panels were fascinating. So unlike our yellow or green or grey panels, red panels supported really different kind of unique communities of marine life. And these were things like lots of barnacles and green algae were really positively associated, really commonly found on these panels. We found that the effects of colour, like really low down on the seawall, where it's really submerged by the ocean, with a lot of strong effects.
Right. And was that expected? Did you think red would be the favourite?
Well, we weren't sure. Because it's quite hard to know sort of what colours marine life can see. And there's not been that many studies on colour preferences. Sometimes it might be light or dark, you know, they're attracted to light things or dark things, but colour is quite new to the field. So we were quite open and excited to see what we would find.
Right. I came across a thing as well recently, and by the way, it was on a Botany Bay, wasn't it? Which is a very appropriate place for this sort of study, I guess. But is it true things like shrimps have 16 types of photoreceptors? If you come across, there's a question for you now. Some of these sea creatures, yeah, they can see a bigger range of colours, can't they? And shrimps can see up to 16 different colours, as it were, including UV light. And I'm wondering, was there anything along the lines of what grew there that you could have predicted it from what they're able, from what, say, certain organisms can see?
Well, we'd had some kind of previous studies where a couple of different species, kind of barnacles and things, sort of were slightly more attracted to red. But in all previous studies, they haven't kept the brightness constant. So you might have one colour which looks a lot brighter than another, and that might be the attractive factor.
Right.
Whereas all our colours were like the exact same brightness. So if it was grayscale, the exact same colour of grey.
Right.
So in terms of that, it was quite new.
Right.
But we do know that I think some of our marine invertebrates might even if they can only see one colour, you know, compared to the other colours, and that one colour that they can see might seem more attractive.
Right.
Brighter.
What gets me is I didn't know barnacles could see. You know, you wouldn't think that they'd have visual acuity, should we call it. So how come the barnacles were able to spot this was red and not yellow, say?
Yeah, so it goes back to really, really kind of that really early life stage. So you'd hesitate to even call it an eye, you know, something very, very primitive, very, very early life stage. We don't know for sure because there's not been enough research done to really prove that things like barnacles can see colour. But it might be that they're monochromatic and that's, yeah, just able to see one colour. So as you said, your example of like red and yellow, if they're monochromatic towards red, red will just look brighter.
Right.
Than yellow, even if they can't see yellow.
It doesn't really matter, I suppose, at one level, does it?
Exactly.
And I presume what you're... Give us a bit more on how this helped the environment. Is it about maintaining diversity of species? I also read how it could be to do with keeping water clean, because these types of organisms can have clean water, can't it? So there's a few applications for this, isn't there?
Yes, there's a few applications. And long-term applications as well. Like we had effects of our study lasting well into 12 months. So with the applications of this study, yes, it's to increase things like biodiversity, healthier, more resilient oceans, but that in turn gives back benefits like cleaner, more accessible water, perhaps better recreational fishing opportunities. So eco-engineering, the whole point of this study is that it's a win-win. So for the marine life in the water,
yeah,
but also for how we use our coastlines.
Right. Is it scalable? That's a big question, I guess, Holly, isn't it? This will cost money, won't it, to paint or whatever, or put in colour panels as we're building seawalls and so on. But you think it is scalable, do you?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the really exciting part, is that all we did to the concrete is we added some very cheap non-toxic oxide. And you mix it in when you're doing your concrete, and that's it. So in terms of it being scalable, I mean, anyone could do that with concrete. And if you know what sort of natural habitat was there before the seawall, you might be able to get an idea of what colours you could use, and then it could be rolled out, you know, potentially worldwide, because harbours are worldwide.
Yeah. And what strikes me is that, I mean, the water's warmer there, isn't it, in Botany Bay? It's much warmer. So, but will it work in Ireland, do you think? There's no reason to assume it wouldn't, I presume.
I don't think there's no reason it wouldn't work in Ireland or Scotland or anywhere. Because we were doing it in sort of Sydney Harbour, the main part. But we have, I mean, if you look at, I was up at the Scottish Islands a few a few weeks ago, and you see so many different colours of the seaweeds and the algae and the rocks, and there's no reason why it couldn't work here. I think marine life uses colour all over the world.
Right. I'm imagining a future where all our harbours and seafronts are covered in all these wonderful coloured sort of structures, and yep, it'll brighten up our lives hugely anyway, won't it, if we see all these different colours coming out?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, as I say, win-win benefits for us and the marine life itself. Yeah.
And what's next, do you think? I mean, hopefully people will pay attention to this. Do you think people will begin adopting this and using coloured concrete and so on when they're building a harbour or yep, renovating a seawall? I presume that's your hope.
Yes, yeah, there is. There's so much more exciting research to be done in this field, and to see like what colours work best for different places and different sites. So I really, really do hope so. And as well, why stop there? We can integrate colour into other things. For example, if you are adding rock pools to a seawall, you know, you can add colour to those structures. And there's lots of different eco-engineering going on around seawalls, and colour could definitely be part of it.
Fantastic. I hope people are listening now who are building a seawall as we speak, and they may consider adding colour into their production. Holly, thank you very much indeed. That's Holly Cunningham, who is lead author on a fascinating paper on how colourful seawalls can revive marine ecosystems. Thanks very much, Holly.
Thank you.
Now, time to chat about some of your texts and tweets that have come in. First of all, we have a message. What determines the birth sex of a child? Well, that was straightforward, actually. It's the X and Y chromosomes, obviously. And if the sperm has an X and goes into the egg, you get two X's, that's a female. If it's a Y, that goes in and then you get a male. Is after age 28 what's defined as geriatric motherhood? That's from Lucy. Lucy, I don't know, to be honest. I think certainly women in their mid-30s are called geriatric mothers. Maybe that's getting younger. I'm not quite sure how they're defining it. It does sound a bit strange, the word geriatric, doesn't it? It just means an older mother, I guess. Another one on birth. How stringently do these statistics apply to the US versus Ireland, for example? That was from David in Cork. I think it's pretty similar, to be honest, David. All over the place, the statistics would apply, wherever you look at them. That's it for this episode. Thanks to Marais O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin and Hugo De Silva on sound. And thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.